you don't, some of the problems that you don't face. And something I alluded to but didn't go into detail was the Yosef, or specifically the Ephraim problem that is faced by Gidon and by Yiftach, who is Gidon being a good king, Yiftach being, or good, almost king, Yiftach being a very, very bad shofet. Both of them encounter what I would call the Ephraim problem. And actually the Medrash that I quoted at the top of the page is very interesting. What it says is, it says, Vayamak Gidon b'seva tova, that he died in a good old age. So the Medrash comes down on a little. It says, you didn't really deserve it. Why didn't he deserve it? Because he built this ephod. He built an ephod. He built a... And all of the people were mizana after the ephod. It got turned into a avodah zarah. What's interesting is that the Medrash actually gives him a break as it goes on. At the end of the Medrash, it actually says he didn't have intentions for it to be a avodah zarah, but it became a avodah zarah. It's mashma from the psukim that way. That's certainly what the psukim seem to indicate. He wasn't trying to be a melech. While he wasn't trying to be a melech, which is what he was supposed to be, he wasn't trying to be oved avodah zarah. He wanted to be the Kohen Gadol. He wanted people come up to be bring sacrifices. He thought it was a better job. Well, what's interesting about the Medrash is this part of it. On the second line, it says, the Lama Asa Ifod. Why did he make an Ifod? What was the motivating factor? Lefisha Menashe Lohayaba Avnei Ifod. That is, the names of the tribes, Menashe was not there. Yosef wasn't there. Ephraim replaced Menashe, that's our Masorah, that Ephraim was on one of the stones of the Ifod, was Ephraim. Otherwise, there were 11 other tribes, including Levi. Ki'im Ephraim, v'lo hayalo mazal, he wouldn't have luck. He felt that it was a certain absence of luck. Why? Because Gidon was not from Shevet Ephraim, he was from Shevet Menashe. V'fichach asa'o, he made it that way. V'af al pisha asa'o l'shem shamayim, and he made it l'shem shamayim. He didn't have any luck. Why? Because he put Menashe's name replacing Ephraim's name, and therefore the ephod did not have the same power, didn't have the same kedusha, as it were, that it should have had if Ephraim. What that seems to indicate is not just, I don't think that the...
Why didn't it have Yosef?
Because Yosef was placed by Ephraim. I don't know why it didn't just have Yosef, but... Right, but what's interesting right here is Pharis and the Medrash, that the Ephod had Ephraim's name, and not Yosef's name. Now, I have to say, I'm not an expert. I should have done more research on it to make sure that that's right. So we should probably cross-reference this. Nonetheless, it seems pretty straightforward from this Medrash that Yosef's name wasn't on it. It was replaced by Ephraim. And we'll talk a little bit about the swap of Yosef and Ephraim. Ephraim, of course, was given... we know Ephraim, you know, the switcheroo of the hands, that Ephraim was given the nod on top of Menashe. The question was, what was really the need to break them into two anyway? And I'll talk about that a little bit as we go on. But more than just the question about whether he built or did not build a correct Kabbalistic device supporting his own Shevet, the real problem, what strikes me, is that he had a certain, in Hebrew, Rikshei Nechidut, he had an inferiority complex. That is, what bothered him about the regular ephod, which, what was wrong with the regular ephod? All he wanted to do was be the Kohen Gadol, so get the regular ephod, which was sitting around, it wasn't a Yerushalayim, there was no Yerushalayim. In fact, there was Heter Bamot at the time. Get yourself a regular ephod, move it up to your Beit HaMikdash that you want to build in your own house. Zan, what's the big deal? So it seems to indicate that he specifically wanted to make a statement about removing Ephraim's name, putting on Menashe's name. If you remember, Devorah was from Shevet Ephraim. She was. We spoke about last week about how she wasn't able to pull the 12 tribes together, but only 6. Gidon goes a lot farther, and yet what seems to be bugging him is just from Menashe. Not only that, we see that Ephraim comes up to Gidon and they give him a hard time. Right? He goes to battle, he wins the battle against Zebach and Salmunah, he beats up Amalek and Midian, and Ephraim comes over and they say, I've quoted the pasuk, it's the second one, by Yomer Lev Yish Ephraim, Maha Davar Hazeh Asita Lanu, what did you do to us, Ephraim says. L'vildik Krot Lanu, how come you didn't call us to go to battle with you? Ki Alachta Lechem Midian, Vayirivun Oto Bichos Khan. They battled him greatly. There was an indication of a blessing, an indication of a physical conflict there. Now, he handles it much better than Yiftach, who we'll see in a second. He assuages them with words. He says, what could I have done? Tovo Dololot Me Ephraim, Ibn Tzir Ebi Ezer, etc., etc. He tells them that they're great guys. Nonetheless, Well, who is Ephraim to come? I mean, what's if you wanted to go to war, Ephraim, go to war. What's your problem with Gideon? I mean, come on, give the guy a break. What's interesting is we not only see it once, we see it twice. When Yiftah, who's not even on this side of, he's not even on the right side of the Eretz Israel of the Yardain line, he's on the other side, right? He lives, he's Shevet God. He's from Hare Gilboa, so he's Shevet God. Gideon was Menashe. Yiftah was from Shevet God. Right? God, Reuven, God, Hatzif, Shevet. Yeah, he's from God. When Ephraim comes up to him, and they say almost the same words, Vayitzak ish Ephraim. Here, the word Vayitzak implies the real a war, that they're coming much more serious. Vayavort Safon, and they come up to God. Vayomer Yiftach, Madua Avarta Lilachem B'vnei Amon. How dare you do this? V'lanu lo karat. Same thing. So why does Ephraim think, there's an impression that Ephraim feels like they have a say in whatever political maneuverings are going on. The truth is, it's correct. Why? Because I actually discussed in the first year, Yaakov blesses Yosef, and he says, Nazirachad alechav. He appoints him, to a certain extent, as a leader. There's this old conflict between Yehuda and Ephraim, or Yehuda and Yosef. And who represented Yosef more? Represented by Ephraim, who was given the bracha. In fact, what's interesting is Divrei HaYamim, which concerns itself, it's a repeat of Sefer Melachim to a certain extent, but what's interesting about Divrei HaYamim is it takes a very political standpoint. Its focus is politics. Take a look at this, the Psukim, where it goes through the tribes. U'bnei Ruvain b'chor Yisrael, and it's about to discuss the B'nei Ruvain, and yet it stops. And then it says, Ki hu ha-b'chor, u'b'chalalo yitzuei aviv, and when he messed around with his father's bed, or the posts on his father's bed, natna b'chorah told of B'nei Yosef. It's b'feirish. Took the b'chorah away from Ruvain and B'nei Yosef. But it doesn't stop there. Veloli tiaches the b'chorah, but don't think that he gets the b'chorah, ki Yehuda gavar be'achav, because Yehuda actually becomes the b'chorah. Of course, it was written much later, or was edited much later, based on earlier documents. So they had hindsight, which you can't say that Shmuel had. The great battle between Yehuda and Ephraim was not yet decided on who would take over the leadership. The authors of Divrei HaYamim, or the editors of the Divrei HaYamim, did have the advantage. They were able to give us a Tuesday morning quarterback's view of what was going on. But what's clear here is that the Bechorah stays, the Bechorah stays with Yosef, which, by the way, explains Ephraim and Menashe. Why do Ephraim and Menashe get two parcels of land as opposed to one parcel of land? Because he's the Bechorah. This is the Bechor. If Reuven had kept on the Bechorut, and we'll discuss exactly that little problem with his father's bed a little bit later, then he would have had two portions. But the Bechor gets two portions. That's the rule of the Bechor. Nonetheless, there is a difference between Bechorut, meaning the firstborn, and leadership. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So Yosef feels through all of this, and it goes back all the way to it goes back to Yosef's time as in the Yosef. Yosef was the leader, was the first official leader of his people. I mean, yeah, he was the leader of Mitzrayim, but he certainly had control over his people. He probably one-upped Yehuda to a certain extent. That idea of leadership carries on, and it even, to a certain extent, carries on with Yaakov's blessing. Yaakov is a little bit wishy-washy. It's not clear who's getting the nod, Yosef or Yehuda. If we turn the page, leaving that aside, well, I'm not going to solve the Yosef problem yet. First, I'm going to discuss the Yehuda problem. You know, we discussed something interesting. I had a map when we discussed Devorah. We had the thumbs up and the thumbs down thing. I don't know if you're here for that. Which tribe she managed to get together and which tribe she didn't manage together. So the tribes that she had, she sings at the bed, Zvulum, Mechokek, Beshevet, Zofer, and then she curses Reuven, Rukdole, Chikikelev, Lama Yashavda, Ben Amishbatayim, Shmosh, Shmur, Kol Arib. She's saying it bitterly. So there were six tribes that did not listen to Devorah, did not come. Four tribes, sorry, that she mentions did not come along to her help, and six tribes that did. And Gideon takes care of the four tribes that didn't come. We see that Asher is fighting with Gideon, and then the two tribes, I don't know if you remember, when he goes over the river to battle against Zebach and Salmonah, who are running away into what's now Transjordan, he goes to a place called Machanaim, and he says, give me bread, because I'm chasing after Zebach and Salmonah. And they say, no, we don't want to. That's Reuven, the ones who didn't want to come across. So he burns them down. He burns them down. He works with their treaties. One city burns down. The other one he simply kills or puts into the hospital the leaders of the city. So Gideon takes care of things very nicely. But what's interesting is Shevet Yehuda and Shevet Shimon, who was absorbed into Yehuda, is not mentioned by either one. Interesting, right? She goes all of her way to mention 10 tribes, the 4 who would refuse to come along with Devorah, and the 6 who came along with Devorah. What about Yehuda and Shimon, its attachment? Its attachment. What happened to them? Not only, we never know. They're never mentioned. Not only that, Gidon talks about all the ones that all the tribes that, that Devorah failed to come across, but once again, where's Yehuda? See, it's not so much what Yehuda did wrong, it's what it's their total absence of the sheer Devorah. Why doesn't she criticize them? There's something else interesting going on when it comes to Shmuel. When Shaul takes over the leadership, before that, let's talk about before what happens with Shaul, before Shaul takes over the leadership. There's an interesting story about an Aron. They take the Aron into battle. Remember that story? Hophni and Pinchas, the children of Eli. And it's captured, for reasons that we'll discuss in a little bit. But it's captured by the Plishtim. It gives the Plishtim a big, nasty time, something straight out of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So they want to send it back. So they what's that? Right, and the whole kind of disease, and chorim, and all kinds of terrible things. So they send it, they put it on Agalach HaLashah, and they send it back up to Israel. Where does it stop? Anybody know? No, no, not Kiryat Yarim. It won't get that. That's where it stops second. Where does it go first? It goes to Beit Shemesh. Read it. Listen to the Pesukim. Vagala ba'a el sadeh Yehoshua Beit HaShemshi. It goes to Yehoshua Beit HaShemshi. Vatamod Sham ve'Evan Gdolan. He had a big stone there, and obviously it was a big stone for what purpose? Why do you have big stones? It was a Mizbeach. Right? That's why you have big stones. There was nothing wrong with that. There was a Heter Bamot at the time. Why? Shiloh had been destroyed. Shiloh had been destroyed a year before when the Aron was taken. Right after they took the Aron, they didn't stop there and say, oh, we got the Aron, we're going to go home. They went up to Shiloh and destroyed it. There's a Heter Bamot. Everybody's allowed to do Mizbeach wherever they want. Vayivka'u et tatzei ha'agalah et ha'parot. They broke it apart. V'ha'levi'im. They had Levi'im there in Beit Shemesh. Horidu et Aron Hashem v'et argaz asherito. Bo Kleya Zahav, where the gifts, the golden gifts they sent up, Yesimu al Evan Gdola, they put it on this Mizbeach, Van Shebe Chemish Halu alot, Vizivchuz Vachim, Bayomahul Hashem. Sounds good. Nothing wrong yet, right? All of a sudden, out of nowhere, what happens? Vayhi Maka, I'm sorry, I didn't quote it here, so let me go to the, read it from inside the Tanakh. It's, if you have a Tanakh, it's Shmuel Aleph Perek Vav. Here it is. Pasuk Yud Tet, Vayach ba'anshei Beit Shemesh, and Vayach ba'anshei Beit Shemesh, and there was a hitting, or it implies a disease against Beit Shemesh. Ki ra'u baron Hashem. What does that mean? They saw on their own. So you have a picture of, again, something like at a Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like they lifted up the top to see what's going on, right? You get the impression, but there's something much more sublime going on than just that simple thing. Vayach ba'am shivim ish chamishim elef ish. And there were 70 people died and 50,000 people died. Very difficult pasuk. We're not going to get into a full explanation of what that means. 70 people, 50,000. Vayitablu ha'am ki ka Hashem ba'am ba'kag dola. And they were upset because of this disease. Look, they were doing good things. Nothing said they did something wrong. All we know is that they seem to have peaked inside the Aron HaKodesh. But, I mean, besides that, they're doing alot, zvachim, there's a heter bamot. What's wrong? So what do they do? Vayishlechu malachim el yoshvei kiryat ya'arim lemor. So they call kiryat ya'arim, and they say, listen, you take it from us. And it goes and it sits in kiryat ya'arim. What shevet is Beit Shemesh? Anybody? Beit Shemesh, I'm sure you know where it is. You go west of Yerushalayim, and then south. So which Shevet is it? Yehuda. Shevet Yehuda. And Kiryat Ya'arim is on the border of Yehuda and Binyamin. And I'll show why that's so important in a second. But just reading the Pesukim, what seems to be a problem, Vayar Baron Elohim, the reason why we picture them picking up the kaporet and looking in is because we can't understand what the punishment is unless they actually went and they touched it. But when that happens by David, right, when David's bringing back the Aron, it's about to fall down by Yishmetu Abakar, and they push it up there, it's beferish. Here was Vayaret Aron. So I want to pose to you the problem was with Yehuda, Shevet Yehuda. What did Yehuda forget about? Let's forget about the punishment for a second. Let's go with their motivation. What did Yehuda want? Yehuda had this big Evan. There was a Heter Bamot. The Shiloh was destroyed. They just got back the Aron Elohim, and they put it right on the Evan, the big Evan that they're doing this Be'ez on. What have they de facto created? De facto created a new Beit HaMikdash. You can't look, it's hard to look at it any other way. I believe, and I'll show you why in another page or two, Vayar Baron Elohim doesn't necessarily mean that they looked inside, although they may have, but I don't think so. It means that they... maybe they looked at it in a certain way, or they established it in a certain way that it was usher for them to establish. No, you're right. You're right. There is a sense of exposure there. That's true. And it could be... Right, that they have exposed it. What's interesting, though, and you're right, that may be the ultimately what they punished for, but the motivation I find interesting. The fact that Yehuda wanted to make the Beit HaMikdash, there's a Chiddush. Well, we always take for granted that the Beit HaMikdash will be where Hashem says the Beit HaMikdash, but here's you, and no, but no, no time was it ever in Shevet Yehuda. The Beit HaMikdash was always in, always, except for one case in Shiloh, was always in the cities of Binyamin. We'll get to that in a second.
So
every
what
time.
What were they supposed to do?
Send it to Kiryat Yarim in the first place. We'll get to Shevet Binyamin. I'll show you why sending it to Kiryat. What exactly? So there's a question. Why did they send it to Kiryat Yarim? Why didn't they send it to Hebron? Why didn't they send it to Be'er Sheva? Why didn't they send it to Dan? What? Shiloh was destroyed. No, the Pelishtim were in control of Shiloh. Yeah, yeah. But what's interesting is, but let's go with that. Let's say they could have sent it somewhere in Shevet Ephraim. Right, there were places Shevet Ephraim. In fact, we'll find that Shmuel has a power base in Shevet Ephraim in a place called the Ramatayim Sofim. Why not send it to Shmuel's town, Ramatayim Sofim? But we'll find that Shmuel doesn't even shofet et ha'am in his own town. Where does he go to shofet et ha'am? I'll take you there in a second. But it won't
doesn't
be.
He
hopefully,
travel all over?
He travels only in Shevet Binyamin. Yeah, we'll take a look in a second. So the Yehuda problem, I believe, is, and again, it all stems from that original bracha, which is that Yehuda. As a source, I mean, Yehuda himself was a melech. We know internally that Yehuda had rights to Malchut based on Yaakov's bracha, based on our understanding of the Pshat. So it's no surprise. The truth is, it seems even worse than Ephraim. Ephraim was at least integrated enough with Menasheh and with God and the other tribes that if the other tribes tried to take power for themselves, Ephraim got all excited about it and wanted to demand what was going on. Nobody, people left alone Yehuda. It's like nobody messed with Yehuda. It's a separate entity altogether. There's a division, a very real division between the north and the south that exists here to the point that they don't even want to talk about Yehuda. But what's clear is that Yehuda has its own interests in setting up its own shop at the time. So where do Yosef and Yehuda meet? Here's an interesting medrash, which is when Yehuda comes down to visit Yosef, and we're going to talk about this a little bit in length because Binyamin is the key factor. Yehuda has come down to speak to Yosef, vayagesh alav, right? He goes to him, and he's talking about what? He's saying, I refuse to let you keep Binyamin, because he's actually been meshabed himself. He's promised his life for the sake of Binyamin. We'll get back there in a second. And there's this, according to the Medrash, I won't go into it specifically, there's this gargantuan battle. His hair grows, and he's chewing iron, and all kinds of, there's this massive battle between Yosef is like the Incredible Hulk, and Yehuda is like Superman, and they're battling each other. This is way out medrash. I mean, clearly it's not meant to be pshat. So what's the understanding? The understanding is that there was a titanic battle, Maase Avot Siman Lebanim. It was an indication, a foreshadowing of the battling that would go on between Yehuda and Yosef. And more specifically, Yehuda and Ephraim. When we see this, it goes on forever. It came together for a short period of time by Yehuda with David and Shlomo, and then quickly split apart again between the conflict between the two states. It almost got together by Achav, almost, but failed to get together. And then things went even worse after that. There's always this conflict, and the Titanic battle is described as being almost genetic or metagenetic. It starts at the very children, this battle between the two great ones. So how did God resolve the battle? What's interesting is what it does is it solves the battle by using an intermediary. And that intermediary is the child that they were both willing to give their lives for. Yosef, because he was his younger brother. And Yehuda, because he understood the love of his father for Rachel. We'll talk about Sefer Ruth in a second, a little bit. But what's interesting is if you take a look at Yehoshua, when it's describing the territory of of Binyamin, it says Vayal Goral Mateh Bnei Binyamin Lemishpachotam Vayetze Gvul Goralam Ben Bnei Yehuda Uben Bnei Yosef. Now the truth was it actually between the specific tribal lands of Yehuda and Yosef? It wasn't exactly. It was between which tribal lands? Between Yehuda and who was immediately to the north? Not just all of Yosef, a specific part of Yosef, right? It was just Ephraim. So why does the Torah use this Yosef concept? Because it's trying to tell you that what's politically true and what's emotionally true is also geographically true, because it all merges into one spiritual entity. And essentially, Binyamin becomes the mediator or the merge or the synthesis, if you will, between Yehuda's strengths and Yosef's strengths, specifically Ephraim. If you take a look at the map, you'll see that Ephraim is to the north and Yehuda is to the south. We'll talk about Reuven and Dan in a second. However, the nod seems to be going away from, you would have said prima facie that if you had one who was a little, who would be the closer brother to Binyamin, who would be the one who was more attached? You would say prima facie would be Ephraim, because they're from the same mother. And yet, what do we see? That when Yerovam is battling against Rehoboam, that is, Yerovam is going to be the first king of northern Israel. Rehoboam is the son of Shlomo. Achiah Shiloni comes over to Yerovam, and he rips his clothes into 12 pieces, and he gives 10 to Yerovam, and he gives 2 to Rehoboam. And he says, you get 10 tribes, and Yehuda gets 2 tribes, and it never even specifies what tribe it is. All it says is Hashevet Ha'echad. Whenever you have those two Ha's together, Hashevet Ha'echad, it's telling you that the important tribe goes to Yehuda. Who does it turn out that important tribe is going to be? You might have said Shimon, because Shimon is absorbed into Yehuda. It's not. I don't know whatever happened. Maybe Shimon went north after the split of the government. I don't know. It's always been a mystery to me what actually happened to Shimon. Maybe they completely disappeared. But my guess is they probably migrated to the north. I can't understand this pasuk any other way. Because what's clear is that when they actually come to do battle, Yehuda is together with who? With Binyamin. And in fact, Yerushalayim, the place of the final Mikdash, is on the border between... And... Exactly right. And the same by Kiryat Yarim. Take a look at the map. This is a map drawn by Rabbi Yoel ben Nun. And the maps don't always... There is some conflict about where the borders go, but this is what Rabbi Yoel ben Nun does. Kiryat Yarim. It goes right through Kiryat Yarim, which is where Yehuda should have sent it up in the first place. That's what Rabbi Yoel ben Nun maintains. They never should have gone with the idea of keeping the Mikdash for himself. It always should have been merged between Yehuda and Binyamin. And if you think about it, there is a sense to it. There is where intuitively you might have said that Yosef should have gone with Binyamin. If you really want to combine all 12 tribes from two different mothers together, you're better off combining what? You're better off combining children from two separate tribes. It makes more intuitive sense, not only from that is better if you want to keep Rachel's children from splitting off from Yosef's children, if you want to create a synergy between the two, then you're better off creating a tighter role between Yehuda, who is from Rachel, Yehuda, who is from Leah, thank you very much, and Binyamin, who is from Rachel. In fact, that's an interesting thing that happens in Rut. At the end of Rut, it actually says, Kisara, what is Rut? Ki Rachel the Leah. Everybody's wondering, why did these Bnei Binyamin say Rachel and Leah? Why didn't they say Leah and Rachel? Because they admitted the Medrashed, Rashi comes in, he said they admitted that Rachel was the true love of Yaakov, and by identifying that, it actually made them stronger. That's a very important synergy, which is necessary. Binyamin is the way that the tribes all come together. Binyamin is special. If you flip over to the next page, Nachla Kodesh, I want to show you some pretty interesting things. What makes Binyamin? I mean, if you just read the bracha that Moshe gives to the tribes at the end of his life, what does he give to Binyamin? Binyamin Amar, Yedid Hashem, the friend of God, Yishkon Levetach Alav, who lives on him with Levetach means with safety or with, what was the word?
Security.
Right, by the way, look at that word Yishkon. That word Yishkon, of course, Mishkan, no is no trick. Chafef alav kol hayom, he hovers on him all the time. Uben ktefav shachein, and he rests between his shoulders. Now, it sounds beautiful and poetic and meaningless, right? It's like, I saw the flower, and it was a beautiful, wondrous flower. But the words, the adjectives, sometimes there's that old joke when you read marketing literature, they say about marketing literature, the software was wonderfully accurate, fantastically precise, giving the user exactly what they want. There's an old joke that what it proves is that marketing people know how to use the thesaurus on their Microsoft Word. They just simply know how to use the words. But there's something very deep going on. What is ben ktefav shachein, between your shoulders? It seems like a totally superfluous idea. Until you take a look at Nachalat, look at the map. See if you can see something. You see something interesting about Nachalat Binyamin? You can see it right there in the center of the map. And I would like to read to you when Binyamin is actually getting his territory, let me read to you how his territory is described.
What am I missing? Where is Nachalat?
Binyamin is right dead center in the middle.
Oh.
Do you see it,
Binyamin?
Yeah, that's right. Nachalat Binyamin. Now look at the borders of Binyamin. I'll read it to you shortly and it'll become more obvious. It's in Perek, I think, let's see. Here it is. It's in Yudchet, Yud Aleph. Vayal goral matei b'nei Binyamin l'mishpochotam. Vayetzei gvul goralam ben b'nei Yehuda u'ben b'nei Yosef. Vayihilahem gvul l'fat zafona, what was to the north, m'nei Yarden. Vala gvul el ketef Yericho, the shoulders of Yericho. Now, it doesn't mean shoulders, it means hills, foothills, mountains, of course. And let's continue on. Miva'ala bahar yama avahayat hotzafa midbara beidabim. Vavar shama gvul luza. Where is Luz, of course? Beit El, the famous Beit El. El Ketef Luz. Negbahi Beit El. Vayarad Agvul Atarat Adar El Al Hahar. Asher Min Negev Beit Choron Tachton. Vatar Agvul, the border went on. Vanasav Lepat Yam Negba, went to the south. Min Ahar Asher El Pnei Beit Choron. Negbahi Totzotav El Kiryat Baal. Hu Kiryat Ya'arim. Ufat Negma Mikse Kiryat Ya'arim. Vayata Agvul Yam Vayata El Mayan Menetoh. Hold on. Vayarad Agvul El Kse Ahar Asher Pnei Ge Ben Hinom. Asher be'emek Rafayim, this is where it goes through Yushalayim. Vayarad ge'eninom el ketef ha'yivusi. How is Yushalayim described? The shoulders of the Yivusi. Vayarad emro gel, vatar mitzafon, vayala ketef this, va'avar al ketef mul haravat tzafona, vayarad haravata. Va'avar agul al ketef beit chogla. Do you see that? Repeating over and over. No other tribe on mountains described that way, except actually for one other tribe when it's describing Yushalayim, Yehuda. But it only mentions it once, ketef Yivusi. Look at this over and over. Ketef, ketef, ketef. In fact, look at the borders carefully. Do you see that? Ketef Yericho, ketef Yivusi, ketef Har Yarim, ketef Luza, ketef HaYivusi, Ke'emek. Do you see that? Oh, of course. Oh! Yehoshua wrote, and he knew about the bracha, but what he's telling you is something very interesting. He's telling you that there is a holiness. That is Ben Tefav Shachem. He rests in the shoulders of God. What is the shoulders, Yehuda is telling you? Binyamin was destined to be where it was. There's no, I know they all had a goral, right? So you expect that the land was random. I could show you in many cases the land was not random. They knew where they were going to be way ahead of time. It's true by Zvulun and Yisachar. Their very brachot hint at where they were supposed to be. Binyamin, it was not only that, Moshe was telling Yehoshua where they had to go. But what's interesting is not only mountains, Luz is not a mountain, but it calls it Ketef Luz. Why? What's special about Beit El? Beit El was the place where Yaakov saw the dream. And what do we know about that? The Sulam went up from Beit El, and there's a problem. What does he say? He made Petach Elohim Mishar Shamayim, right? That's what he says. It's the place of God, and it's the gates of the heavens. So Chazal are very upset. They don't understand why it's in Beit El and not in Yerushalayim. So they have this medrash that the Sulam was on an Al-Chason. It was on an angle, and it goes up to Yerushalayim, and it's true. It's not true from a pshat sense, of course, but it's true from a spiritual sense. That is, the two places, only two cities are called Ketef, which is Ketef Yivusi, which is specifically Har Abayit, Har Tzion, and Ketef Luza, which is where Beit El was. And we'll see how that affects us by Shaul, if I manage to keep going on time. What's interesting, if you flip back a page, but keep your finger on this page, look at the configuration of Binyamin. Binyamin has Ephraim on the north and Yehuda on the south. Okay, we understand that because there's supposed to be a synergy. But look who's on the right, Reuven to the east and Dan to the west. Now, with that in mind, switch over to the formation of the Mishkan while they're walking through the desert, and you will see something very, very interesting. Who are they surrounded by? The Mishkan itself is surrounded by the same four tribes. Nice, right? Now, what's interesting is it's not the exact same configuration. Dan is to the north. You have to hold it upside down. Dan is they're going east because they're going in the direction of Yehuda, by the way.
Yeah, but Dan picked up and moved up into the Golan.
That's true. We'll talk about it in a second. You're absolutely right. Very, very good. In fact, what seems to be indicated, if you look at Yaakov's bracha by Dan, it specifically says, Babashan Yishkon or something like that. They specifically wanted that area up in the Golan. Dan didn't want this territory that they were put in. They were put in against their will. They had the worst enemies. Their enemies were the Tel Aviv Yafa'ins. It was the worst enemies. They had problems with Shalvim. They were chased all the way up to the Shalvim Mountains, almost on the border of Binyamin. What we find out in Shaul is that they've essentially, by the time Shaul is around, Dan has almost abandoned their territory. They've gone up to Dan in the Golan Heights, and we see that Yehuda is control of the cities of Dan to the south, and Ephraim is control of Dan's cities to north. But at the time that they're giving out the tribes, they give out the tribes matching the configuration surrounding Binyamin is exactly the configuration of the tribes surrounding the Mishkan, also indicating the holiness and spirituality of Binyamin as a tribe and the land which Binyamin is as a geosociological force or a metageological force. I don't even know how to say it correctly. Now, what's interesting is it's switched 90 degrees and inverted 180 on its y-axis. Why? I don't know. And by the way, why these tribes? These tribes are significant tribes. Reuben, of course, is the Bechor, right? The original Bechor. Dan is actually Bechor. Bechor of what? Bechor of the Pelugshim, right? He was the oldest one of the Shifchot. Right? He was Bilhah's first child, making him the oldest of Gad and Asher, right? From Leah's. So Dan was also, by the way, from Rachel's descendants. But he was the oldest, so it makes sense. These four tribes make a lot of sense when it comes to who would surround, who would be the forces surrounding the Mishkan. But it's Binyamin that sits in the middle. Rabbi Yoel ben Nun explains that actually Dan got the water side. That is, he was on the water side when they were going through the desert, right? Because the water was to the north. Right? They were going through the Sinai, so the water's to the north. I don't know. I'm not a Kabbalist. I don't know why it had to be inverted 180 and switched around 90 degrees. But the fact that they're surrounding this area, I mean, you can't miss that. It just kind of jumps at you. And there are other reasons, of course, why Binyamin is Kodesh. Binyamin was the only son who was what? Born in Eretz Yisrael. Right? The only one who was born in Eretz Yisrael. Not only that, here's going to be an issue that's going to... Correct? He was the only one. Now, here's a tough one. I'm going to say this to you, and you're not going to like it, and then we're going to have to work through it on the next page. He was the only one born on his own tribal land. Why don't you like that? Tell me why you don't like that. Where was he born? Where did Rachel die? On the way to where? Kiryat Beilechem, which is in whose tribe? Yehuda's tribe. It's going to give us problems with Shaul, because when Shmuel talks to Shaul, he says, you're about to meet people coming from Kever Rachel, which is in Shevet Binyamin. And the Chazal go nuts. The Chazal themselves grapple with this issue, and we'll discuss it a little bit here. But there are a lot of reasons why Binyamin is not only just a de facto pshara synthesis between Yehuda and Ephraim. He is specifically born the Kedusha, and it is Ephraim's job and Yehuda's job to support and synergize into that Kedusha. Not only that, every city, if you flip back two pages, look at all those cities. Except for Shiloh, every other place where there was a Mikdash was in Shevet Binyamin. You have the Gilgal, you have Beit El, you have Kiryat Yarim, you have Yerushalayim, and there were other places too. Nov, remember the city of Nov that Shaul destroyed? That's there. The mitzvah where Shmuel gathers everybody together to bring a sacrifice, to battle against the Plishtim. Also in Shevet Binyamin, every single one, except for Shiloh, is there. We actually discussed when we talked about Yehoshua. Why? Because Yehoshua had to put the Beit HaMikdash in his own territory, because everybody was, all the tribes were sitting around the Gilgal, and they wouldn't move. They were happy. They were all this tribal land sitting in Shevet Binyamin, and they were happy. They had this nice thing. Why did they have to go and fight enemies for it? They got this whole nice Yericho area. So essentially, what Yehoshua was doing was he moved the Mikdash up into his own territory, because that would force the Shevatim to go and set up their own lands, among other reasons. Now, let us, with that in mind, I think what I've spent a half an hour doing is establishing the importance of Sefer Binyamin. Because you might have a question. I can understand where you might need a Melech Yosef, because Yosef was a Melech, and he gets a bracha that he's a Melech. I can understand where Yehuda should be the Melech. Where's the Binyamin thing? So essentially, the last half hour was trying to prove the importance of the Binyamin, and that's what Hashem wants to give it a try. The first officially sanctioned king, not really, I mean, there were previous ones, but the first officially accepted king, if you ask people who was the first king of Israel, certainly people would jump and say Shaul. It's not exactly accurate, but it's not exactly inaccurate as well. Why Binyamin? Based on exactly what we've been discussing, the holiness of Binyamin. Now I'd like to talk about, and what's interesting about Shaul is that he's chosen exactly in the same way that Gideon is chosen and that Moshe is chosen. You have the part where Shmuel goes over to him. This is in Shmuel, I don't know, probably Parachet or so. Shmuel goes to him. And he gives him a bracha and says that Hashem has chosen him. Let me get that part. He goes, Shmuel ra'at Shaul v'Hashem anahu hine ha'ish asher amarti lacha zeh yatzor batzmi. And Hashem whispers in Shmuel's ear, says, this is the guy. Vayiga Shaul Shmuel b'toch hashar. Shaul goes over to Shmuel. Vayomer hagida na eze beit haroeh. And he says, hey, where's the prophet's house? Not knowing that Shmuel is the one he's looking for in the first place. Vayan Shmuel Shaul Vayomer Anochi Haroeh Alei Lefanai HaBama, go up to where we're doing sacrifices. Va'achaltem Imi Hayom, and you will eat from those sacrifices. V'Shalachticha BaBoker, and then I will send you out on your message. V'Chol Asher Bilvavecha Gilach, and I will tell you everything that's in your heart. U'Latonot Avodot Lecha Shlosh Emim, and these donkeys that you're chasing around, Al Tasimit Libchalehem Kinenzel. First of all, they're found, and also V'Lemikolchem Da Yisrael Halo Lecha. You have control over all of Israel. He's giving him a message here, right? He's saying, you are chosen. He's the prophet. He's choosing him. What happens right afterwards? We have the humbleness that we saw with Shlomo and with Gideon. What does he say? Vayan Shol Vayomer Halo Benyamini Anochi. I'm a Binyamin guy. What do you go to Ephraim? Go to Yehuda. What are you bothering with me for? Also, he says, Anochi Miktanei Shitei Israel. I'm the smallest shevet of Israel. U'mishpachti atzira mikol mishpachot shitei Binyamin. In my tribe, it's exactly the same words we saw at the Gidon. It's this humility, which is necessary before you take the job of the king. I mean, we know that Shaul fails later, and we'll discuss why. But at this point, so far, so good. There's nothing wrong. It's very good what he's doing. And then Shmuel, what happens immediately afterwards? What's the next thing that happens after humility, both by Gidon and by Shlomo? What did we say? The next thing that comes has to be the oath. And we discussed last week that an oath is not a sign. It is a covenant. Oath in the sense of a brit. It is a deal that is an indication that something is going on. I'd like to talk about the oath a little bit that Shaul got. And there were three oaths. And he says to him, when you see these three things, the chalafta vahita le'ishacher, you will be a different person. You will know that you're supposed to be the king. You will know that things are in your hand. What are the three oaths? We need to, they're very, very vague. We can spend easily hours on them, and I'm gonna give maybe each one a few minutes. The first oath, each oath is important. It's not, if you look at it, it's not something, there's no miracle there. It's an indication that Shaul is supposed to perform these acts to show him to show him in a natural way that Hashem is with him. So what is the oath? The first oath is a very interesting thing. He tells him, you're going to go from there looking for your atonot, looking for your mules, and you're going to see two people who are coming from Kever Rachel, Asher b'Binyamin b'Tzeltzach. Chazal go nuts. That's the first thing. And they will tell you, forget about the donkeys. Don't worry about the donkeys, because the donkeys aren't the problem. Your father found the donkeys. Your father is worried that you're a dead man. Don't forget that the plishtim are everywhere. It's like driving the... It's like, you know, drive from Yerushalayim to Gush Etzion now. I mean, there's a concern there. I mean, probably 100 times more of a concern. The Plishtim were all over the place. They really were. We'll see that they were in Shaul's hometown. The second oath is he will go to a place called Beit El. And Beit El is famous for the story of Yaakov. He comes back there, and he buries two people really there. Not exactly there. One, he buries a very strange woman called Dvorah, who is the Meneket Rivka, a woman we've never heard of, never hear of again, and all of a sudden it's this crying, terrible situation. What? But we betrayed, exactly right. And we'll see an Alon here also. So he goes up to Beit El, and he sees people coming, going up to the Bama to bring sacrifices, and they're going to give him two lechems, two pieces of lechem, and they're going to say, Shalom Lecha. no miracle, just a whatever. The third one seems a little more miraculous. He's going to go back to his hometown. Why is he going to go back to his hometown? Essentially, he was on the way home in the first place because the first guys from were coming from Kever Rachel were telling him to go home now because your father thinks you're dead. So he's on the way home, and when he's home, which is the place where the Plishtim are, then he's going to see a Chevel Nevi'im, a whole big group of Nevi'im, and you're going to be Menabe with him. You're going to become part of that Nevuatic, you're going to have a Nevuah as well. What's the purpose of the oath? So quickly, spending only 5 minutes of it, so I could, I hate to short shrift it, because again, we could spend a whole shiur on it. I believe what was going on, see, Chazal have a big problem with the whole Kever Rachel thing. Chazal say, wait a second, Kever Rachel was not in Shevet Binyamin, it was in Shevet Yehuda. So what's going on? In fact, the Ramban himself has a problem. When the Ramban is writing, first he wrote Sefer Vayechi. He wrote his parish on Sefer Vayechi. And there, where Yaakov makes Yosef promise that he's going to take him back, he mentions the whole thing about how he buried his mother on the way down to Beit Lachem. And there the Ramban says that therefore it proves that he was in Shevet Binyamin. The Ramban later is writing on the earlier story, which happened at Beit El, when actually Rachel dies. He says, listen, I'm in Israel now, and I can tell you, Kever Rachel is not in Shevet Binyamin. It is 10 kilometers south of Shevet Binyamin. There's no way. And therefore, I think what it meant, it was on the way, and he explains here this and that. But there's a machloket, a chazal. Some say that it was in Shevet Binyamin, and some say that it wasn't Shevet Binyamin. Nonetheless, it's hard to argue with the Masorah that we have. We clearly feel that it's in Shevet Yehuda. I mean, I don't know if it's exactly, we have the exact right spot, but it's hard to say, you know, there's an old thing that if you want to find out what the true halacha is, go and look out what the people are doing because they know the truth. That kind of heavy Masorah, you're not going to have a real mess around by that. And there are those who explain that what does the pasuk mean? That they were coming from Kever Rachel, that they were leaving Kever Rachel at the exact same time that Shmuel was talking to Shaul, and they're going to meet in the middle on the border of Shevet Binyamin. Either way you look at it, though, what does it mean? What it means is that there is a synergy. I believe what the Ode is indicating is that there's a synergy process going on between Binyamin and Yehuda. And that was the first important sign. Shaul needed that, because Shaul is, for the first time, not just going to be a leader of his own people, northern Israel, where Ephraim might get upset, but now what Shaul needs to know is that Yehuda is involved. And Yehuda did, in fact, get involved with the whole picture. By meeting these people who were from Binyamin, who went down to Kever Rachel to worship at the grave, and or to pray at the grave, and then to come back and meet them on the border, where, what does Chazal say Tzeltzach is? Chazal say Tzeltzach was not, there's no other, Tzeltzach is not mentioned anywhere else in the Tanakh. So what does Chazal say? Tzeltzach is none other than Tzeltzach, the shadow of greatness. What is it? Yerushalayim, Harabayim. That's where they met them. It's again, what I believe the Ode is trying to do is to show that synergy is happening, Shaul. Yehuda and Binyamin are close. There's trade, there are people moving back and forth. And Rachel, who is the symbol of that, now, what I believe, by the way, I'm sorry to cut my sentence short, I believe that Rachel is buried where we think she's buried, and I believe it's also in Shevet Binyamin. How do I believe that's possible? I believe that that little area of Shevet Yehuda is like Swaziland in the middle of South Africa. I believe that by Rachel dying there, Shevet Binyamin got that little piece of tribe. Now, I don't have any proof for this, although Rav Elitzur from Gush mentions it, although not so clear, not exactly the way I'm doing it, but he says that essentially it was like an extension. What he pictures is like a line going all the way down. What I picture is an ex-geographic territory, that this would be the seal of the territory that would seal together Yehuda and Binyamin, and that's what I believe is correct. I mean, there are many who are. Rav Yoel Ben-Nun disagrees. He says that the Kever Rachel that we know today is not Kever Rachel at all, and Kever Rachel is clearly in Binyamin. What's that? Kivrat Beit Lachem. So they say that's very...
Right, Ephrat Beit Lachem.
Ephrat is Beit Lachem, right? Beit Lachem.
Ephrat is what? Ephrat is the Shevet Ephraim.
No. Ephrat is Beit Lachem. What do we say in roots? Ashim Ephratim may Shevet Beit Lachem. No. Take a look at Rashi there. Ephrat is Beit Lachem. Now, it's true that Shmuel's father was called Ish Ephrati, but that means Ephraim. But Ephrat is Beit Lachem. Ephratah he Beit Lachem. That we're sure about. Although there are those who say that they was actually talking about a different Ephrat.
He didn't take
it even to Beit Lachem. He was on the way. Kivrat means he was within walking distance. Take a look at Rashi and Ramban there. Very, 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 very clear there. Where Ramban isn't so clear is when Ramban's talking about it back in Beit El. Now, the second place they go, of course, where did Rachel die? She died Kivrat Beit Lachem, on the way to Beit Lachem, but the whole story takes place actually in Beit El, and two people get buried in Beit El. I'm not going to go into the who Devorah is, the medrash is that she was written, not other than Rivka herself, very difficult, but there's a medrash there. But she was important enough that they have Alon Bachut. In this, the whole story of going down and burying Rachel seems almost ancillary. What's important about the story about the Beit El is that Yaakov comes back to Eretz Yisrael and he gets rid of the Avodah Zarah that he's picked up from Shechem, and he rebuilds this temple that he had on the way out, right? He didn't just make a Mizbeach like his father and his fathers did. Vayitzok alav shemen, he puts shemen on. He creates a mini Beit Mikdash in Beit El. There is a holiness to Beit El, and that's why it's important. When Shaul goes in there, it's, again, a synergy that the whole Yaakov process is taking place again. This whole repetition of history is repeating itself, and good things are happening. In the final place, he goes home, and look at the people. They're happy. They're dancing. You know what? If you had Plishtim who would set up Netzivei Plishtim in your town, do you think you'd go dance? They were coming down from the Bama. They were sacrificing to God, and they were dancing, and they were mitnabim, they were shaking, and they were having nevuah, etc., etc. Would you really do that out in the open, coming down from a mountain in the main city of where the Plishtim had set up? That's what it says specifically, that they were Netzivei Plishtim. You might be more cautious. What it is a natural sign that the tide is changing for Shaul. And by Shaul understanding that, A, he's got Yehuda on his sides. B, there is a destruction of the Avodah Zarah, which was causing Yaakov problems. That's why you had to go to Beit El to get rid of the Avodah Zarah. Plus the holiness and the birth of Yehuda. Plus the idea that there's a rebirth in Binyamin itself. That would tell Shaul that the time is now, the place is Binyamin, and you're supposed to be the king. And that would be the oath, the deal that was taking place. I'm running a little behind, so I'm going to... Skip to the next page, the human factor. What I didn't do, however, you know what? There is more on this page. Well, let's skip on. What is Shaul's problem? We discussed Shaul's problem a little bit, and what's interesting is Shaul actually, his first sin was not with the Amalek, which you might have thought. His first sin is simply was Makriv Korban. He acted out as the Kohen Gadol, just like Gidon did. I'm not going to go into that because we've discussed about the merging of church and state to ad nauseum. So I'd like to talk about what causes that. What are the fundamentals? Why would somebody want the job of high priest rather than the job of political leader? Mm-hmm. I think the problem is to be found in Shmuel. Of course, Shmuel is writing his own sefer. The problem is to be found before Shaul. If you look at what happens to Shaul, at the real sin, what's going on when Amalek comes, is Shmuel comes up to him and says, how dare you not kill, what are you doing? And he says, what are you talking about? I did a mitzvah to Hashem. Can't even say I went wrong. He says, ma kol ha'amon hazeh, what about all the shrieking I hear from the goods of Amalek, from the sheep of Amalek? Oh, not my fault, it was the people's fault. They said, how dare you do that? He blames the people because the people said this, and the people said that. He's always blaming the people. Now, one problem was that he didn't immediately do tshuva. Putting that aside for right now, because we'll discuss the non-tshuva issue, that Shaul had a hard time admitting he was wrong. When he was not admitting he was wrong, who was he pointing his finger at? At the people. Not only that, when Shaul first loses his job, he doesn't lose the kingdom totally, he loses just his job when he goes and he raises the sacrifice. Who gets the focus then afterwards? His son, Yonatan. The story moves to Yonatan. In fact, if you think about the story, what happens to Yonatan? They do this big battle. There are no swords, and Yonatan sneaks down into the battle area of the Plishtim, and he hears them talking, and he realizes from their conversation that now's the time to roll down that rock because everybody will start killing each other. Who does it sound exactly like? A guy who sneaks down into a military camp that they're vastly outnumbered, and with two people manages to destroy the entire town. Who does it sound exactly like? Exactly like Gidon. So Yonatan here is actually being described by Shmuel as Gidon. He's telling you, listen, this was the right guy. What happens afterwards during Amalek, do you remember what happened? Shaul says, nobody eats. because we are holy spiritual people, and we're going to chase these godless Plishtim down to their people. In the Torah, Shmuel through Yonatan is obvious. Yonatan says, "My father, achartem et Am Yisrael," because if we had only been able to eat some food, what happens to Yonatan? He sticks his staff into the honey, he puts it in his mouth, v'ha'ir enav, and his eyes get bright because he's got some food, he's got some calories in him, he's got some energy in him, and he goes and he does a little bit of battle. But based on that pasuk, it's very clear, the pasuk specifically says that the reason why they weren't able to vanquish the Plishtim on that day is because of this neder to Hashem. Isn't a neder to Hashem a good thing? What was Shaul missing? I think Shaul was missing the same thing Eli was missing, and at the very beginning of the Sefer. Look at something very interesting. You probably read it around Rosh Hashanah, but I'd like you to notice something for the first time. Eli is giving Musar to his good-for-nothing sons. And what does he say? Oh, no, I'm sorry, before that. You guys are probably going to jump on me because I've had people jump on me before, but I'm convinced that this is right. When he's telling Musar to his good-for-nothing sons, I want to talk about the bad thing that happens. His good-for-nothing sons, Hophni and Pinchas, take the Aron, and the Aron gets taken, right? And the runner comes back, Vayanam Vaser, a runner comes back, Vayomer Nas Yisrael, he talks to Eli, who's still the shofet at the time, Vayomer Nas Yisrael, the Fnei Plishtim, they get chased away. V'gam magefa gdola hayta ba'am, and many, many Jews died. V'gam shnei banecha meitu, and your two children die. Chofni u'pinchas. V'aron Elohim nilkacha. And the Aron of God is taken. Now I want you to notice that pay there. There's a stop. The Torah wants you to pause and think about that for a second. And then what does it hit you with? What's the next pasuk? V'yehi kaz kiro et Aron ha'elohim. V'yapal me'al kisei achoranit. He has a heart attack and he dies. What caused him to have a heart attack? The Torah emphasizes the words. What part of the message? The message contained a lot of facts. We've lost the war. Thousands, tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 Jews died. Your sons are dead, and the Aron is taken. What grabs Eli's attention? What caused him to have a heart attack? Is that good or bad? Is that good or bad? Think about it.
That he should be so upset.
But that the Torah specifically, the Navi specifically wants you to know what caused his death. Is Shmuel complimenting Eli's focus or insulting Eli's focus? You might think. And I got to tell you, people, I go the other way, and I'll tell you what the other way is.
It's like Aaron, you see, Vayidon Aaron,
why? Because his sons died. Vayidon Aaron, Vayidon Aaron, even though his sons died, he knew he had a job to do. You're right. However, it bugs me. Maybe it's because I'm a 21st century humanist. But if I was sitting there, even if I was the Kohen Gadol, even if I was the Shofet, and you might think it's my responsibility to worry about the Aron, and you came and you told me that 100,000 people died, and I mean, don't think of it in terms of stick figures of the Tanakh. Picture yourself in that situation. Your sons. Oh my God, I think I'm going to cry if I think of that. My daughters.
Well, that's why we put it in your eyes. I mean, if for a person who stand up on such a high platform, so you shouldn't be looking on the selfish side, you should be looking on the cloud side. And for the cloud side, even though that the people die, but the
you're right,
overall
I would,
picture
so you're saying,
is the Aron Hashem.
That's
is
what
God.
People told me. People told me that I'm not Eli. If I was Eli, I'd have a different view. However, I want to support my view. You can disagree with me, by all means. Many people do. Hopefully, I'll even find one person who agree with me. Look at something else that Shmuel is telling us. Two other things. The first one is where he's talking to his good-for-nothing sons, and he says, Al benai, do you see that Shmuel al perek bechaf dalet? Al benai, ki lo tova hashmua asher anochi shomea. I'm hearing terrible things from you that you're stealing from the Kodesh, and you're hurting people's feelings, and you're threatening people. Ma'avrim et am Hashem, and you're causing people to astray from God. Im yechate ish le'ish ufilalo Elohim. If a person does aveira ben adam lewat, l'chaveiro, Hashem could pray for you. But if you sin against God, who's going to pray for you? They didn't hear you. Which means, according to Eli's Musar to Pinchas and Chofni, what's worse, an Avera ben Adam l'chavero or an Avera ben Adam l'makom? Avera ben Adam l'makom. Why? Because God isn't there to pray. If you insult God, who's going to support you? And I got to tell you, when you read this, if you can't read this superficially, you have to look at it. It has to bother you, and I know I'm not Eli, but as Shmuel was writing for the humans, he was writing for us typical Jews, and I believe that the whole basis of the story of Noah versus the story of the Mabul versus, I'm sorry, the story of the Mabul versus the story of the Flaga. We know it's ingrained on our basic Judaism that Avero ben Adam l'Chavero are 1,000 times worse than Adam l'Makom. Because Hashem could forgive you, but people are a different status. And look at what it says about Shmuel. What does it say when Shmuel actually takes the leadership? What does it say about him? Vayitav oto gam im Elohim v'gam im Adam. That's what it says. When Shmuel actually comes through, let me read it to you inside, because I'm not reading the pasuk exactly correct, but when Shmuel is taking over, when he is becoming the leader, it says, it goes out of its way to specifically say, let's see if I can find it. I know I'm running late on time. Good. Vanash, right after this whole case, in contrast to this Musser, which has to strike you as very strange, what does it say immediately afterwards? Vanash Shmuel halach v'gadel v'tov gamim Hashem v'gamim anashim. Why would it go out of its way to say gamim, if I don't care? Hey, if you're a Kohen Gadol, you shouldn't care about the fact that 100,000 Jews just croaked. You shouldn't care about the fact that your people just lost the battle and their political integrity is geographic area is about to die. You shouldn't care about your two kids who you raised and you carried in your arms and you suckled in your breast. That's not what's important to you. What's important to you is your relationship to God, and that's actually what Eli says to his sons. And yet the Torah hits us right afterwards and says, no. Shmuel gam tovim anashim v'gam elokim. And now take a look at Shaul's problem. Why did Shaul want to be? What Yonatan understood, Yonatan was a humanist, and that's a good thing. And Gidon's fault, but more to the point, Shaul's fault. Shaul felt was that he had to be close to God. He wanted to be the Kohen Gadol because that was the way he felt that to maximize your Jewish experience, you go and daven. That's what you do. You're makriv korbanot. What does Shmuel say to him? This is some of the most beautiful lines in all of Tanakh. It's on the previous page. The most important mussar you could ever give. When Shmuel says, I didn't do anything wrong, what does he say? Vayomer Shmuel, Hachafetz Hashem ba'alotus vachim. You think God cares about alotus vachim? Kishmol b'kol Hashem. What does he want you to do? He wants you to listen to him. Hinei shomea mizevach tov. Listen to God. That's better than an important sacrifice. Lahakshiv, and to pay attention. Mechel v'alim. Hichatat kesem meri. Because the sacrifice of an idiot is bitter. I don't know if Kesem exactly did, or of a fool. But Avenu Trafim and all those things in the Beit HaMikdash, they're worth nothing. Yan Ma'asta Tvar Hashem. Because you've gone against the people. Why have you gone against the people? What did you do wrong? Not just that you didn't kill Amalek. Why is it important to kill Amalek? It's important to kill Amalek because ki ain shmo shalem v'ain kisei shalem, as long as Amalek will not alive. Because the truth is that Amalek threatens God's existence. But on a more practical sense, who does Amalek threaten? B'nai Israel's existence. So I'm not saying chas v'shalom that he shouldn't have cared about the Aron. I believe he should have. He should have croaked on all of them. The pasuk, if it wasn't trying to insult him, it just would have said he croaked afterwards. It wouldn't have to give a psik stop. Now I'm going to tell you that he croaked because he hears the Aron. It's okay. He's a Kohen Gadol. He has to care about the Aron. He cares about the people. He cares about his sons. But it focuses just on the God thing. And after what we see by Shmuel's Musser, I think it's clear here, at least it's clear to me, that the problem with being just a spiritual guy, just a Kohen, that you lose a connection with the people. It's already 10 o'clock, but with that, I would like to go to the last page and tell you a little bit about what I'll skip a little bit. The Rav, I heard this from the Rav, the Soloveitchik. So what's the whole conflict between... The whole conflict between Yosef and Yehuda is the conflict between a tzaddik and a balchu. Yosef, if you look at Yosef's words, Yosef is working for Paro. You're working for Potiphar. And everything's going great. And this woman comes over, probably a beautiful Egyptian woman, comes over and says, hey, you get it on? You would expect him to say, no, chas v'shalom, it's a gilui araot, I can't do that. I'm sorry, you're attractive, but sorry, I can't do it. His speech is totally different. His speech is, listen, my boss put me in charge, he's giving me control of everything, and the only thing he has to give me control of is you, and therefore, how could I possibly do such a terrible thing to my master? wow. I mean, I was like, he's not even affected. It's like the story, I know I've told this before, it's like the story of Gandhi, how he used to put 16-year-old girls in front of his mat to prove that he wouldn't fool around with it. Gandhi was an idiot. We don't, as Jews, take that standpoint. And we don't take that standpoint because it's non-humanist. And yet that's Yosef, right? Yosef is such a tzaddik, he didn't understand what he was doing wrong. His brother, the children of Bilhah and Zilpah are doing things wrong, and he comes back to rat on them. Why not understand them a little? Why not work with them a little bit? Yehuda, on the other hand, was a sinner. Another sinner, by the way, is Reuven. Reuven, the sin that he did with his father, father's pilugshim. We don't have time to go into it. I believe he did the sin with his father's pilugshim, because when you take a pilegesh, like Adoniyahu tried to do with David, and it's all when you take the pilegesh as king, what you're saying is I'm grabbing the power of the kingdom. Reuven wanted to seal his fate that he was the poor, because obviously Yaakov was already looking towards Yosef. I believe that's what's going on, but I don't want to go into more depth. Yehuda, Reuven tries to do tshuva. And even when they put away Binyamin, Reuven goes over and says, listen, right? The first person who wanted to put his life on the line for Binyamin was not Yehuda, it was Reuven. And Reuven says, if Binyamin dies, I'll give you my two kids. And what's that? Right. And what is, and look at the Rashi, it's something very interesting. And Reuven and Yaakov rejects it. Look at Rashi. Loki bel d'varav shel Reuven, amar b'chor shota huze. He's a b'chor, he's an idiot. Hu omer li lahamit banav. He's telling me that I should kill his sins. That's not, you know, it's not the death that's bothering him. Look at point to Rashi, based on the chazal. L'chi banav him? V'lo banai? They're not his kids. They're my kids. He doesn't even understand that I need replacement for the act. I'm no idiot. Yaakov's no idiot. I lost a kid. You already paid me back with your children. That was a done deal. Don't think you're doing me any gifts. It's when Yehuda is willing to put his own life on the line. That's the kind of tshuva that you need. And the whole story of Tamar. What's the story of Tamar? If not a man who goes down to the vayet olav, vayet meet achav, a guy who goes down to the depths of to the point where he's not only want to be Mekayim Mitzvah, he wants to destroy his own line, his children. He marries a Canaanite. I know it's arguable, the Medrash is not clear, but he seems to be marrying the Canaanite, the very people that Rivka said, oy vavoy, if my son marries a Canaanite. And then what does he say about Tamar? He said, Kamimeni. The recognition that there are other, you can be wrong and that others could do right. What does Rav Soloveitchik say? Rav Soloveitchik says like this, you know, we talked a lot about the idea that if you try to merge the powers of church and state together, it creates this. Tachlis, though, what causes that desire to be too super holy? What causes that desire, according to Rav Soloveitchik, what he says about Yosef and Yehuda, he says, Yosef, the job of the king ultimately is to be shofet, is to take God to the people, is to be shofet them and to understand them and to work with their problems. If you're not a sinner, you cannot understand your people. Yosef should not have been king. I know you'll tell me that most of the kings of northern Israel were actually bigger sinners than Yehuda, but the truth is, look very carefully at their sins. Most of them were not sinners because they were Oved Avodah Zarah. Most of them did the same sin as Yerovam ben Nevat, and his only sin was from making people worship Hashem not in Yerushalayim, which is what Hashem wanted, but in his own town, whether it was Shomron, or whether it was in Dan, or whether it was in Gibeon. It wasn't Avodah Zarah in most of those cases. They got nailed good for going against Achiah Shiloni, who said, listen, you could have the northern tribe politically, but make sure your people come down to Yerushalayim when it's time to come down to Yerushalayim. And that was their sin, because they took upon themselves a kedusha. Even Yaakov's bracha at the end of Bereishit, what does he say? Nazir echad achiv, echad al achiv, which means a leader on your brothers. But I think the word nazir is indicative of course, a holiness. I believe that the Bechor breaks down into two things. The political, humanistic Bechor, the practical Bechor, and the spiritual Kedusha Bechor. And both of them have an important place. Rav Soloveitchik, during his shir on this very subject, said that it's the same as the battles of the Baal Shem Tov against the Grum. He says that Midnagim against the Hasidim was the same thing. He says what happens is that the Grum would sit in his room and he'd actually close the windows and not even go outside to see what was going on. Well, what did Baal Shem Tov do? He took his people and he brought religion out to the people. He said that's why Yehuda was capable of being the king. We know that what did David do right, and what did Yehuda do right? Yehuda recognizes sin, and so did David. David takes Bathsheba, he commits almost the ultimate sin with him, and as soon as Natan comes down on him, right away, Chatati Lashem, no pause, no break. So you might think what a Melech needs to do is to be able to admit his sins, and it's true. But if you just say that, you might be missing the makor of how a king is possible to admit his sins. A king is only possible of admitting his sins, and we, everybody, are only possible admitting of the sins if we recognize ourselves as human beings. And if we're able to look at other people and say, yeah, a little bit of that evil that I see in other people, I'm in that. And a little bit of my evil I see in other people, and I understand them. And if you could forgive yourself, it's not just so important that the king could forgive himself, to do tshuva himself, and it is important when you have a lineage. You always have to be able to have sons who can bring themselves back from the brink of evil. But what's more important is you cannot understand that your people are sinners if you're not a sinner yourself. And that's why it was only Yehuda. Yehuda never wanted to be the Kohen Gadol except for that one instant there, and he never made that mistake again. Shevet Yehuda tried it with Beit Shemesh, and they got rid of it right away. They were not fooled. They didn't want to be the Kohanim. They had no interest in being the Kohanim. They were the people's kings. They understood that the job of the Kohen is to be pure and perfect. And he's the one who's supposed to represent the people to God and say, our people are perfect, and try to forgive us and look at us if we're perfect. But the king who needs to bring God to the people has to understand that the people have fallacies, and only when you have fallacies and you recognize those fallacies are you able to do tshuva. And only when you're able to do tshuva, you have the ability of establishing malchut at all. Have a good night. Thank you, by the way. This is the last